Yeah, I turned on the TV and they were showing on the news. They had some procession, clowns and. In fact, the kids is silly.
You're being transmitted.
Okay. This way?
No, we won't be able to see it.
He's not in a trunk.
He's listening. He's passing.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah,
here
it is, right there.
Okay.
Yeah. So they found it.
Okay.
Might as well get started, right? Okay. It's my pleasure to introduce Meyer Taktürk as our speaker today. Meyer is our faculty candidate interviewing our department for the position we advertised. He's planning to complete his PhD studies in May of this year at the University of Rochester Computer Science Department. Meyer's area of interest are complex computer and algorithms. And today he is going to give a talk in about his research.
Thank you. I'm here.
Thanks for the weather.
Where I'm coming from, it's still snow on the ground. It's still below freezing. And it's going to be like that for at least April. So my talk today is going to be about broad brush theorems for determining problem complexity. This is work joined with Lane Hemispandra, who is my thesis advisor, and this is going to be one chapter of my thesis. So computer programmers, scientists, and engineers need to determine complexity of problems on a near daily basis. When we face a problem, when we come across a problem, we typically ask the following kinds of questions. Is this problem hard? Is this easy? If it's hard, how hard is it? If it's easy, can we have a really fast algorithm for it? If it's hard, can we still have approximation algorithms for it? However, different problems fall in different complexity classes. So the proofs for their problem classification are different. Moreover, even problems that lie in the same complexity class might have vastly different proofs for problem classification. Just to give you an example, this slide shows four well-known and well-studied problems from the area of graphs. Their currently best-known problem classification and the proof for their problem classification. I'll go over them one by one. Shortest path, as we all probably know, is the problem of given a graph and two nodes in the graph, finding the shortest path between those two nodes. And it is easily has a polynomial time algorithm, and the proof, so it's in P, and the proof that it is in P is the well-known Dijkstra's algorithm. It's a simple greedy algorithm. Vertex cover is the problem of given a graph finding a set of vertices such that for every edge, at least one of its endpoints is in that set. So finding a smallest sized such set. And it is known to be NP-complete, and the proof that it is NP-complete is a reduction from the well-known NP-complete problem, satisfiability. All right? Even cycles is the problem of, given a directed or undirected graph, finding whether there is a cycle of even length in it. So cycle of length 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on and so forth. And for a long time, it was not known whether it is in P or it is hard or so on and so forth. But in the last 10 years, both the directed and the undirected versions of this problem have been shown to be in P. But the proofs that they're in P are highly sophisticated techniques from graph miners. So it's not trivial algorithm at all. Graph isomorphism is the problem of, given two graphs, find if the two are isomorphic, or if the two are simple renamings of each other. And for this, we don't know whether it's NP-complete. We don't know whether it has a simple polynomial time algorithm. In fact, it's unlikely that it's NP-complete, but we still don't know, have a polynomial time algorithm.
About two-dimensional graph or three-dimensional graphs?
Any graphs. It's just, so what do you mean by two-dimensional graphs?
You have a planar graphs or
no? This is a
general concept.
Yeah, this is general graph isomorphism. Okay. It's suspected that it's not NP complete, because if it is NP complete, some things that we expect are not true become true, but we don't know whether it has a simple polynomial time algorithm. So there's no proof for problem classification. The point of the slide is that different problems, even from the same domain, have vastly different, or may have vastly different proof for their problem classification. Okay? In the light of this observation, would it not be nice if we had one general tool, one broad brush tool, that in one go would classify a broad class of problems in any given domain into different categories? So this is the point of the talk. So we want one tool that would take a whole bunch of problems from one domain and do the problem classification. So this is what we call as a broad brush theorem, or a broad brush tool. So what it does is, that it takes problems from a specific domain D, and it classifies into three complexity classes, C1, C2, C3, depending on whether the problem L has property foo. Then it will classify it as having complexity C1. If it has property bar, then it will classify it as C2, otherwise it's in C3. Of course, this is not a real theorem, it's just a template so we'll see many such broad brush theorems later in the talk, but this is just to give you an idea of what I mean when I say a broad brush theorem. Okay, so essentially a broad brush theorem takes a problem from this domain and classifies it into C1, C2, 3, C3. 3 is not important, of course, depending on the problem L. Any questions? Okay. So one sort of famous broad brush theorem comes to us from the area of computability theory, and this is the famous Rice's theorem. So this is a theorem from the 1950s, and it says the following. If you give me any language property of programs, and I'll explain exactly what language property is, but if you give me any language property of programs, I will immediately tell you whether it's decidable or undecidable. In fact, all non-trivial properties are undecidable, and there are only two trivial properties that are decidable. So a property of a program is just a collection of programs, okay, which sort of have the property. And a language property is a property that depends only on the language or the function that the program is computing. So just to sort of make things more clear, when I say a program, I basically mean a Turing machine. So I'll use these terms interchangeably. A property of program, as I just said, is just a subset of Turing machines or programs that have that property. Okay. So for example, if I talk about the property program has 17 states. So it is just the collection of Turing machines that have exactly 17 states. Okay? A trivial property is a property such that either all the programs have it or none of them have it. So for example, a trivial property is a property like the program or Turing machine has a start state. Since by definition, all Turing machines have a start state, this is a trivial property because every Turing machine has it. So a non-trivial property is a property such that there's at least one program that has it, and there's at least one program that does not have it. That's why it's non-trivial. And a language property, so this is sort of important, a language property is a property that depends only on the language that the Turing machine accepts. It does not depend on the number of states, it does not depend on any other thing, but it depends only on the language that the Turing machine accepts. For example, I'll give you a list of examples right now, actually. So remember, what Rice's theorem says is that any non-trivial language property is undecidable, any trivial property is decidable. So this basically slide shows that for examples of properties of programs, whether they're language property or not, and if they're language property, are they trivial language property, and what the Rice's theorem says. So let's go over them one by one. So consider the property, does M accept the string 0010? Is this a language property? Remember, a language property is a property that depends only on the language that the program accepts. So is this a language property? Well, yes, because it depends on the acceptance properties of the machine. So it depends on the language. So for any given program, it either accepts it or not. If it accepts 0010, it has the property. If it does not, it does not have the property. Okay? Is this a trivial language property? Remember what a trivial language property is? A trivial language property is a property that either all programs have or no program has. So it is not a trivial property because there is one program that accepts 0010 and there's another program that does not accept 0010. Okay, so it is non-trivial language property. And so the Rice's theorem says that if it is non-trivial and it is a language property, it is undecidable. Okay, so it is undecidable. Okay, let's consider this property. Does the machine or the program have 17 states? 17 is not important, but let's say we have this property. Is this a language property? Does it depend only on the language that the Turing machine accepts? No, because I could have two Turing machines computing the same language, one having 17 states and one having more than 17 states, for example. I could just add dummy states, right? So it is not a language property. And in this case, Rice's theorem says nothing about it. So it's just silent. It just happens that this is an easy property to check, but Rice's theorem says nothing about this. Okay? Let's look at another property. Does the Turing machine accept a finite set? Is this a language property? Remember, a language property is a property that depends only on the language that the machine accepts. So is this a language property? Yes, because either a machine accepts a finite set or it does not. It accepts an infinite set. So it is a language property, and it's also non-trivial because there are machines that accept finite languages and there are machines that accept infinite languages. Okay? So it is non-trivial, and what does the Rice's theorem tell us? It says that if it is non-trivial, it is undecidable. So note that there are only two trivial properties. A trivial property is a subset of Turing machines. The only two trivial properties are the following. The first one is the collection of all Turing machines. The second one is the empty set. Those are the only two trivial properties we have. Because remember, a trivial property is a property that either all Turing machines have or no one has it. Right? So there are only two trivial properties. So except those two trivial properties which are decidable, nothing is decidable, essentially. No language property is decidable. Okay, let's look at the last example. Does M accept a set of strings? Some set of strings. Is it a language property? Yes. Is it a trivial language property? Yes, because every Turing machine accepts some set of strings. It might be a finite set, infinite set. It might be consist of a billion strings, but it is some set of strings, and so the Rice's theorem says that it is decidable. Okay? So after introducing the sort of famous broad brush theorem, what I'll do is go into Boolean circuit properties. The reason we want to look at Boolean circuit properties is because the rest of the talk is about not Rice's theorem, but analogs of Rice's theorem in complexity theory. So this one, the original Rice's theorem, is Rice's theorem in computability theory or automata theory. But what we will look at are analogs in the time-bounded case. And so in particular, in this talk, we'll look at broad brush theorems for Boolean circuit properties. So before we come to the theorem, we want to look at what exactly we mean by Boolean circuit properties and what broad class of properties we are talking about. And then I'll introduce the three Rice-style theorems for Boolean circuit properties. Each one is an improvement of the previous one. And we'll look at the current state, and we'll see if improvements are possible. And in fact, we'll show that the current Rice-style theorem that I have is the optimal in the sense that you cannot improve it in certain mathematical sense. All right? So since all our remaining broad-brush... Yes?
No.
Oh, sorry. Since all our remaining broad-brush theorems are going to be about Boolean circuits, let's define what we mean when you say Boolean circuit. The standard meaning of Boolean circuits is what I'll assume. It's a directed acyclic graph consisting of AND, OR, and NOT gates. And then we encode the Boolean circuit as a string in some standard, easy-to-decode polynomial time way. Okay? There's just one notation that I want to emphasize. It's sharp sub c of x is the number of satisfying assignments of Boolean circuit represented by the string x. So in this case, the number of satisfying assignments is the number of ways you can set x1, x2, x3 as 0, 1, 0 or 1, such that the output is always 1, right? And in this case, you can check that the number of such things is such assignments is 4. Any of these 4 assignments will make the output true. So again, it's a minor point that the number of outputs of the Boolean circuits we are considering is exactly 1 in all cases. So let's look at some properties of Boolean circuits, right? So one property we could want to check whether the number of satisfying assignments of the circuit given to us is exactly 1, okay? One other property that we could want to check will be, does the circuit that is given to us have exactly 17 gates? You know, it's one property. Is the number of satisfying assignments of the circuit at least 1? This is exactly 1, this is at least 1. Is the number of satisfying assignments of the circuit either 0 or 1 or 2 and blah, blah, blah? Another property you might want to check is, does the circuit evaluate to 1 on the all true input? If you set everything on the input side to be true, does the circuit evaluate to 1? So these are some examples of properties we are interested in. Okay? So the broad brush theorem that I'm going to talk about, or the broad brush theorems that I'm going to talk about, all deal with a particular class, a broad class of properties of Boolean circuits. And those properties are the counting properties. So a counting property of a Boolean circuit is a property that depends only on the number of satisfying assignments of the circuit. So again, a counting property of Boolean circuits is a set of Boolean circuits. And it is a set such that the membership in that set of any Boolean circuit depends only on the number of satisfying assignments of the circuit. So consider this as an example, counting of 1, 3, and 5. So this is the set of all Boolean circuits that have either exactly 1 or exactly 3 or exactly 5 satisfying assignments and nothing else. So this simple AND circuit, which has, as we can all see, exactly 1 satisfying assignment, is in this counting property. So it has this counting property. Similarly, this circuit has also sort of not very hard to check that this has exactly 3 satisfying assignments. And even this has this property. On the other hand, the circuit from the previous slide, as we saw, had 4 satisfying assignments. And 4 is not 1, 3, or 5. Okay? So this is not in this property. So it does not have this property. Okay? So one important thing to note is that if you have a counting property, and if you have, say, a circuit that has 3 satisfying assignments, and if this circuit is in the counting property, then every other circuit in the world that has exactly 3 satisfying assignments is also in. Because the counting property, by definition, is a property that depends only on the number of satisfying assignments. Okay? All right. So all our broad brush theorems from now on about Boolean circuits will be about counting properties of Boolean circuits. So let's look at the same five examples that we saw earlier and see if these are counting properties or not. And if they are counting properties, are they trivial counting properties? Again, a trivial property of Boolean circuits is a property that either every circuit has or no circuit has. Okay, so again, there are only two trivial properties. So is the number of satisfying assignments of a circuit equal to 1? Is this a counting property? Remember, a counting property depends only on the number of satisfying assignments. It is, because this is the number of satisfying assignments. So any circuit that has exactly 1 satisfying assignment is in, other circuits are out. Okay? Is this a trivial counting property? It is not trivial, because there are circuits that have exactly 1 satisfying assignment, and there are circuits that don't have exactly 1 satisfying assignment. Does the circuit have 17 gates? Is this a counting property? Does this depend only on the number of satisfying assignment? No, because you could have two different circuits computing the same function. One has 17 gates, one does not have 17 gates. It has dummy gates and stuff. So there's no question that this will be a trivial counting property, because it's not even a counting property. Okay? Is the number of satisfying assignments of the circuit at least 1? Again, this is very similar to this. The sets are different, but it depends only on the number of satisfying assignments. So this is true. This is a counting property. And it is also non-trivial, because there are circuits that have at least 1 satisfying assignments, and there are circuits that don't, that are not. Is the number of satisfying assignments a member of 0, 1, 2, 3, so on and so forth? Well, what this basically is asking is whether the number of satisfying assignments is a number, right? And of course, it's a counting property, and of course, it's true for every circuit. So it's also a trivial property, because every Boolean circuit has it. Okay. The last one: does C evaluate to 1 when you set everything in the input to be 1? Is this a counting property? No, because it does not depend on the number of satisfying assignments. It depends on one particular assignment to the inputs. So it's not even a counting property. Does anyone see that? Remember, a counting property depends only on the number of satisfying assignments, and not on one particular assignment that may or may not be satisfiable. Okay. So this is just to show you what properties are counting and what are not. So researchers in complexity theory have been trying to find analogs of Rice's theorem in complexity theory. So Borchert and Stefan took the first step. And they proved what I call in this talk, just for this talk, as the hurdle jump theorem. And they showed that this broad class of properties, the counting properties for Boolean circuits, is hard for unambiguous non-determinism. I'll explain what that exactly means. But it's slightly less than NP hardness. They didn't prove it's hard for NP, but slightly less. Okay. So this is what I call as the hurdle jump theorem, for reasons that will become clear like right now. Hemispandra and Rota improved their theorem and proved that the same broad class of properties are hard not just for unambiguous non-determinism, which Borchert and Stefan achieved, but also for constant ambiguity non-determinism. So I'll again explain these terms in the next slide. But if you want to think about it in very simple terms, if this is 1, this is any constant. Unambiguous, if it refers to 1, then this is any constant. In my thesis, I show that the same broad class of properties are hard not just for constant ambiguity non-determinism, but also for polynomial ambiguity non-determinism. And if this is 1, this is a constant, and then this is any polynomial. So the progression is 1, constant, polynomial, and that's why we call it the hurdle jump, the high jump, and the pole vault theorem. So this is basically part of my thesis. All right? We'll see more details of it. But essentially, at this point, what is important to see is that the counting properties of Boolean circuits have been proved to be hard in this case. So basically, what this says is non-trivial counting properties of Boolean circuits are either, in this case, they proved it's hard for unambiguous, constant ambiguity, and polynomial ambiguity non-determinism. Okay? So just coming back to that, so what it says is that all non-trivial all non-trivial counting properties of Boolean circuits are, again, I'll just explain this term, but it's hard for polynomial ambiguity non-determinism. And let's look at what, among all these five, which are the non-trivial counting properties. And this is non-trivial, and this is non-trivial, so these are hard. On the other hand, this is a trivial property, so this is easy. It's in P. This is just from a previous slide. I just added one column here. Because we now apply the pole wall theorem that we get, and we get that the non-trivial counting properties are hard, and the trivial counting properties are easy. On the other hand, properties that are not counting properties, we don't say anything about, just like the original Rice's theorem. So we don't say anything about, yes? I'll explain what FuP means.
Okay, now I'm going to ask something else. Any one machine can have both properties that are trivial and non-trivial, so what do you do in that case?
Like for example, machine can have?
Both properties, like for example, the number of satisfying conditions can be one, which is also a, you know, number. So is that right. A trivial or non-trivial one?
So we are talking not about machines, we are talking about properties. So we are, the input is a machine, mm-hmm. Or in this case, not a machine, in fact, a Boolean circuit, right? But we are trying to design an algorithm for to decide a certain property. So I exactly don't get your question.
I see. So you're trying to find out if it satisfies a certain property.
Yes.
And that's
it. So my algorithm should have this property.
Okay.
It should say yes if it has a certain property, one of these properties. I'm trying to design one of them.
Okay.
So it's very easy to do it for this. Mm-hmm. I get any input, I ignore the input, say yes.
Okay.
Because every input has this property. Maybe I check for syntactic well-formedness, but other than that, that's it. Okay?
What is the motivation to focus on counting property rather than other properties? For example, your second example, a circuit has n gates.
Right. That's easy. That's really easy.
And well, this entails the circuit has a certain number of solutions that satisfy in the cycle.
No, you can only have an upper bound. So if it has 17 gates, then you can have at most 2 to the 17 possible configurations of
input. Okay.
So it only has an upper bound, but there's no way to tell what the actual number of satisfying assignments is.
Oh, I see.
Okay, this is just here to show, this example is just to show that there are some cases which we don't handle. And we'll see why that limitation is there, why we cannot improve. In fact, the second part of the talk will show that we cannot even improve our theorem from counting properties to general properties. There are certain limitations imposed on us by mathematics itself. So yeah, you have a good question. Why do we look at just counting properties and not just all properties? I'll show why that is.
No, the type of property you choose should be quite basic. And then I watch this. Why just counting properties?
Right. Exactly. I'll show why. So one reason, one simple answer to that is we can prove things about it.
Okay.
And if you want to increase the size, we cannot prove things about it. So that's one reason. Of course, I would like to have as broad a property as possible, right? But we'll show that you cannot really do it. It's just not possible to do it using standard techniques that we have available today. Proof techniques, I mean. Okay, I'll come to that. Yeah, very good question.
Well,
yeah.
Let me follow up on that.
Yes.
Phrase the question differently. Mm-hmm. Can you think of a practical use of a counting property?
Practical use of a counting property. Okay, so the motivation for this research, as also, I'll also come in the next slide or so, is that we as computer scientists or researchers, we come across problems on all the time. And instead of, so when you come across a problem you want to solve, the instinct is to go and look for algorithms, fast algorithms. What these guys do is, it's a quick and dirty way to prove that no such algorithm exists. So you cannot directly apply the counting property and build a circuit or anything. But it's a way for you as computer scientists or mathematicians or whoever to have a sledgehammer tool. That in one go, you know, just this, it's a black box tool, you don't need to know much about the thing, and you can just focus not on finding a polynomial time algorithm, but on finding, for example, approximation algorithms.
So what you're telling me is that you haven't found an application yet which comes up with this property.
Found an application?
In other words, what you just said is you uncover an application, you're looking for an algorithm for it. This would show you that no such fast algorithm would exist.
Right.
So you haven't found that application yet, any even example application, which then reduces to this thing. Sample problem, any kind of sample practical problem,
properties. Oh, okay. So we would like to see. You have a certain kind of problem, and then you can, hey, I can identify certain content properties.
Right.
And then that'll be interesting. I can apply the content properties.
Oh, I see.
In this case.
So you're asking about.
Then let's see, what is complexity?
A problem that is basically a counting property that occurs in everyday life.
Sure.
Yes, so the answer is I'm looking for it.
Okay.
I haven't found it yet.
Fair enough.
I can give you synthetic examples.
Mm-hmm.
One reason that I haven't found it yet is I haven't worked with closely with people who would face these problems. So one example I can give you, which you cannot. Again, the one of the things that you have to note is that when do you say that the theorem produces a new result? Because these are so, for example, if I say, okay, what is the number, consider a property consisting of Boolean circuits that have prime number of accepting paths, satisfying assignments, right? So, this is, we know that this is PPHard, and there's no other result that I know of that proves that, okay? On the other hand, at least one is, we know that this property is in fact not only PPHard, which is less than NPHard, which in fact is NPHard, because it's just satisfiability. So again, this is a limitation of our thing, that we are not getting as hard. So there's a trade-off between covering a lot of problems and getting the optimal result. So in this, we are not getting the optimal result, for example, in this case, we are not getting the optimal result, which would be NPHardness, but we are covering a whole. We have one proof, one black box, one broad brush theorem that covers a whole lot of problems. Okay? Any other questions? All right. So this slide just shows the application of our theorem. So you can apply it to this, this, and this, but we cannot apply it to anything that is not a counting property. All right? To describe what I mean by unambiguity, polynomial ambiguity, exponential ambiguity, this is the slide. So all the three Riesz-Stiles theorems, all the three theorems that I mentioned on the previous slide, hurdle jump, high jump, and pole vault, all say the following. It says, all say that each non-trivial counting property of circuits is C-hard, where C is one of these. It's either UP, it's or UP big O of 1, or FUP. Right? It's one of these. So this is the first, this is the second, this is the third. So now all these classes are subclasses of NP. So this is the biggest, this is slightly small, this is slightly smaller than that, this is slightly smaller than even that. Okay? And I'll explain what the difference is right now.
Where is NP complete?
I'll come to that. We don't have that, but I'll come to that. So consider NP, right? NP is the set of all sets for which there is a certificate scheme such that if the string is not a member, then you have zero certificates. If the string is a member, then you have at least one. You can have as many as exponential number of certificates, right? But you have a certificate of polynomial length. Okay, so that is what NP is. Now in FUP, you have the same thing for non-membership, but for membership, the number of certificates is restricted to being a polynomial. So you can have at most n squared member certificates. That is just the definition of FUP. That's just by definition. So in NP, the restriction is not, there's no restriction. Whereas in FUP, we have a restriction that the certificate scheme has to be such that the number of certificates for any member is some polynomial, n squared, n cubed, n to the billion, but some polynomial. Okay. And so FUP, I'll also come to why they are sort of useful. FUP has been linked to preprintability of sets in complexity theory. I can talk about more later on, but let me first show what these two mean. So UP big O of 1, which I call as constant ambiguity and non-determinism, is like NP, except
that the restriction is even more severe now. Instead of having polynomial, instead of allowing any polynomial number of certificates, I have the restriction that you have to have some constant number of certificates. It could be 1, 10, 20, a billion, but some constant. Okay? So that's why it's the big O of 1 is the constant here. So this I call, polynomial ambiguity non-determinism, because the ambiguity in the certificates is polynomial. This is exponential because there could be an exponential number of certificates. Okay. Similarly, UP, which has been linked to the one-way functions and cryptography, has exactly one. You have to have exactly one certificate for a member, right? So you can see that this is a subset of this, which is a subset of this. This is a subset of this because this has the most restriction. This has slightly less restriction. This has even less, and this has no restriction at all. Okay. Few. Generally stands for polynomial. When in complexity theory, when you say few parts, you mean polynomial number of parts, because you can handle that, right? Something that comes with.
Is that your terminology?
No. None of these classes have been invented by me, unfortunately. So we, the original theorem was for UP, so we only handle these kinds. So that's why we call unambiguous non-determinism, and then you have constant ambiguity, and so on and so forth. So UP, let me come to why these classes are important in complexity theory and cryptography. So all of these classes, even NP, have been linked to different kinds of one-way functions. So for example, we know that one-way functions exist if and only if P is not equal to NP. On the other hand, if you wanted not just one-way functions, but you wanted one-to-one one-way functions, so injective one-way functions, then you P not equals NP is not sufficient. What you need is P not equals UP, in fact, which is a stronger statement than just saying P not equals NP, right? So the existence of one-way functions has been linked to the separation of P from these classes. So this is why this is important. Another motivation for studying these classes, for example, for UP, is that before the primality, the AKS primality algorithm was known, and even before a few years before that, we knew that primality was, the best known bound for primality was UP. It was known that it had a non-deterministic algorithm with this kind of certificate scheme, 0 or 1. Right? And then it was further improved to ZPP, which is probabilistic. And then finally, 2 years ago, we actually have a polynomial time algorithm for it. So there are important problems that fall in these classes. All right? So now we can sort of finally state the theorem, and we can also sort of understand it a bit. So it says that the strongest known Rice's theorem, or Broadbridge theorem for Boolean circuits, says is what I call the Polvar theorem, says that each non-trivial counting property of Boolean circuits is hard for polynomial ambiguity non-determinism, or FuP. It's hard for FuP. So one thing I should have mentioned for people who are not that familiar with hardness is that when I say hard, I mean that every problem, so if A is hard for B, then every problem in B can be solved using A, right? So this is what I mean. Okay, I apologize for that. So when you say SAT is hard for NP, what you mean is that if you could if you can solve SAT, then you can solve every problem in NP using an easy reduction to SAT, okay? So similarly, that's what we mean here. So in other words, what this is a sort of cryptic statement to explain what the theorem says. It says the following. Can we solve, so I give you a problem in FuP, say problem L, and I also give you a subroutine for a counting property A, you know, a unit time subroutine. So can you solve that problem in FuP using the subroutine for A? And the answer, it says that the answer is yes. In fact, there's a program that runs in polynomial time because we want that. It solves L and uses only a polynomial number of calls to A. So this is sort of follows because it runs in polynomial time. So the number of queries you can ask of A is only polynomial, because at each step you can only ask a polynomial number of queries. But we'll see why that this is sort of important later on. So this is what these two are equivalent statements. So I can solve any problem in FuP using a unit time subroutine to any non-trivial counting property. So this A could be any non-trivial counting property, It need not be a specific one, any non-trivial counting property. Because it said that each non-trivial counting property is few p hard, right? So this property is few p hard. So any problem in few p can be reduced to this in this fashion. Any questions? All right. So yeah, this is something I had referred to Dr. McMillan's question. So what is the use of this? So if we sort of, so this is sort of before and after picture. And if you didn't have the pole wall theorem, you could come to a problem and say, okay, am I missing the obvious algorithm? You know, what is the algorithm? On the other hand, if you knew, you know, if you knew that this was hard, you would sort of stop looking for algorithm and concentrate more on approximation algorithms, which are still possible. Because you know that if it's hard, then you know a lot of people have looked at it, and it's no easy task to find a polynomial time algorithm for it, unless weird things happen. Okay, so basically, this is the use of any broad brush theorem, in the sense that I'm talking about. So they classify problems into different categories, and it's a sledgehammer tool. So you can use a variety, you can classify a variety of problems using just one tool. So you don't need to be an expert in this. All you need to do is sort of be aware of the tool. So Rice's theorem is the same kind of tool. And this is coming back to your question about why just counting properties. So what are the limitations of our pole wall theorem? So one limitation is that it's you might say that it's not broad enough. Why just counting properties? Why not all properties, right? Another limitation is it strong enough? I think it's coming back to your question. Why not NP hardness? Why just few P hardness? And I'll try to answer these questions. The short answer is that the theorem that we have currently cannot be much improved using standard techniques. So you cannot have much improve it from counting properties to all properties, and I'll show why. So in other words, you want to ask, can the pole wall theorem be improved in different directions? So one direction would be to improve from few p to np. One direction would be to improve from counting properties to all properties, and so on and so forth. So this brings me to asking the question. So this is, again, remember, this is the informal statement of the theorem. It says that we can solve any few p problem using a subroutine for a, which is a counting property. Okay, so now if you want to improve this theorem, if you have this theorem, you want to improve it, there are sort of three different directions you can improve it in. Two of them have been already mentioned. So one is your thing, that we can have bigger classes. Why just stop at few p? SPP is another class which I won't go into, but it's also slightly bigger than few p. Okay, so can we have bigger classes? So we are covering more problems. So the second one is related to your question, why have only counting properties? Why do we have this weird condition? Why not all non-trivial properties, okay? The third one is something that I'll explain is historically important in the context of this talk, is instead of using a polynomial number of subroutine calls, why not just use a fewer number of calls? And explain why, what is the motivation for that. So we look at each of these three things and show that, in fact, none of these is possible with the current techniques. So consider improving our statement from non-trivial counting properties to all non-trivial properties of circuit. So I want to claim that all non-trivial properties of circuits, of Boolean circuits, is few p hard, for example. But we have some properties that are non-trivial properties that are really easy, that are in P. For example, this is from the earlier slide. Consider the property all circuits that evaluate to 1 on the all true input. Now, this is a very easy property. All you need to do to check this is go through the graph from top to bottom and just find the values of each of the outputs of each of the gates. This is really easy to do. So if you could prove this thing, then you would essentially have proved that P is equal to few P, which is no one knows, and people suspect it's not true. And definitely, you cannot do it using standard techniques. So this is unlikely. So your question about why counting properties and not why not all non-trivial properties is really hard to prove, at least. OK? Now, to your question, MS Pandran wrote an earlier using Thorin result, we can show that if you can prove NP hardness, then we have some collapses that are not known, that are not expected to hold. So these are complexity containments that we don't expect to hold, NP contained in this parity P. I won't go into the details, but these are results that are both not expected to hold, and there are oracle results that show that this cannot be proved using standard techniques. You need non-relativizable techniques. So this is about, this is also unlikely. All right? So the third one is why have a polynomial number of cores. And the motivation for this is that both the previous two results, the hurdle jump theorem and the high jump theorem, achieve not only polynomial number of cores, but they in fact achieve one core. Right? So in the reduction, you need only ask one question to your oracle, whereas we require polynomial number of cores. So it brings us to the obvious question, if in the light of the fact that this has been improved twice already, why not improve this from polynomial to one? Okay? Remember, when I say subroutine calls, I'm making the subroutine call to my counting property in order to solve a few P problem, in my case. So these guys achieved one call, but we only have polynomial number of calls. But we show in a theorem known as what I call the Walt limit theorem, that using standard techniques, standard relativizable techniques, we cannot improve it from polynomial to one. So even this is unlikely. So you have polynomial, which we already achieve in our pole-Walt theorem, but one is not possible. So in short, all the three directions,
The English here is subtly different. There's two possibilities here. One is that you can prove you can't prove it, and the other is that you've proven you can't do it. Which one is it?
I have proven that it cannot be improved using certain techniques.
Okay.
That's what I've done. So, for people who are not very familiar with relativizable techniques, I cannot give you a long, it will be too hard to explain right now. But in short, most of the techniques, not all results, but most of the techniques that we use in complexity theory and mathematics are relativizable. There are some results like the IP equals P space, which are not relativizable. So what this shows is it's more a result about the nature of mathematics itself than about these problems. It says that mathematical techniques are not strong enough to solve these problems. So for example, we know that we cannot solve P equals NP using standard techniques. So you have to come up with new techniques to solve P equals NP, or to solve P not equals NP, either of these. So this is about the nature of mathematics. So what I'm not claiming that you cannot improve it. What I'm claiming is that you cannot improve it using most of the techniques that exist today. Yes?
I'm not very familiar with the complexity theory, but right. Is that, okay, what you're saying is you cannot improve this theorem.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does it also mean that nobody can actually prove, nobody can come up with a different theorem that can do it in one call? Does it mean that nobody can do it, or does it mean that just you can't prove this theorem?
This is a theorem which says the following. It says that our earlier theorem cannot be improved, which in turn means that nobody using relativizable techniques can improve it from polynomial to one. Nobody using, so there are two things. One is the important thing, that is using standard techniques that exist today, and the second is you cannot improve it from polynomial to one. So now you might ask, what about polynomial to log, polynomial to, so we haven't done that, and we have certain conjectures about that, but what I'm claiming is that using standard techniques, no one can improve our theorem, which means in turn that no one can improve it from polynomial to one.
But what do you mean by standard technique?
Okay, so
you need to study all these techniques.
No,
if you miss one, I don't know.
I'll tell you. So most techniques that we have are, when I say standard, I mean actually relativizable. Relativizable is the more technical term, and by relativizable I mean the following. In complexity theory, if you could prove a statement S, this is some mathematical statement, right? Most techniques that exist, again, the definition of most is sort of fuzzy, but most techniques that exist, there are only few results that are non-relativizable. You can also prove not just S, but you could prove S to the A, where A is an oracle. Or it's relative. So what you mean is that S is true not only in this world, but in all oracle worlds. So for example, if you could prove P equals NP using standard relativizable techniques, you could also prove this, right? So most techniques that exist in complexity theory and mathematics, for example, diagonalization or substitution, all these are relativizable in this sense. I can talk about more about oracles and relativization one-on-one, but essentially the point is that a lot of the technique, or most of the techniques that we use are proof techniques.
Well, my feeling is your claim sounds more philosophical rather than technical.
No, this is a technical, it has a technical meaning. It might sound philosophical there, but what I exactly mean is this. I cannot, so the thing is that, yes, it is fuzzy in the sense that you cannot list techniques. So that's why I'm not claiming, I'm not listing you the techniques, because it's very difficult to list proof techniques. What do you mean by a proof technique, right? But most proof techniques that exist today are relativizable, that we know.
Okay.
So that, in that sense, it is not technical. But the claim there, it says, I'm not claiming anything about a particular technique. I'm saying that if it is relativizable, so if I give you a proof, so if I have a statement here, and I give you a proof, and now you can, and from this proof, you can have a proof of not just S, but S to the A, then this is relativizable. And it is found that most, if you look at any complexity theory book, most of the techniques are of this form. So if you can prove this, then you can also prove this. Okay? But this is again an oracle or a subroutine call, right? So if a statement holds with respect to, in the real world, it also holds with respect to the oracle world. Okay, so in that sense, it is not. It has a precise technical meaning.
Okay.
So to say whether a proof is relativizable or not, you actually have to go into the proof. And if you look at most proofs, they are actually relativizable.
Okay.
IP equals P space has a proof that is not relativizable, for example. But most of the other ones are.
Okay.
Okay. So, no, but this is a real theorem. If I had more time, I would give you the proof of this, like 5 hours or so, because this is a really long proof. But in the time that I have, I just want to sort of give a basic flavor of the proof. So the flavor of the proof is very combinatorial. You want to exploit, so you have machines, you have non-deterministic machines, and you want to exploit their limitation, the number of calls they make, the number of, the length of the queries they can make. And one tool that we use is a tool called Party Lemma. And this is from Tsai et al. In 1988, their Boolean hierarchy paper, and it says the following. Suppose you have a party, and you have guests at the party, and these are all the guests at the party. So, and each guest knows a certain number of other guests. For example, this guy knows this guy and this guy, and similarly, this guy knows this guy, so on and so forth, right? Now, the party lemma says is that if you add up all the acquaintances of all the people, and it's reasonably small, then you can find a group of reasonably big group of perfect strangers, where a perfect stranger group is a group such that no person in the group knows any other person in the group, right? So if you have, we are at a party, and I know you, I know him, he knows him, and so on and so forth. But if all these acquaintance lists, so in this case, all the edges, the number of edges, are few, with few has some technical meaning, but I'm not going to go into that, then we can always find a group of perfect strangers. So in this case, these three are a group of perfect strangers, because this guy doesn't know this guy, this guy doesn't know this guy, and this guy doesn't know this guy. Okay? This is just a baby example. So we use this, in our case, the guys are certificates of Turing machines or paths of Turing machines. It's just to give you a flavor. It's just a very, very vague flavor of the proof. Alright? So just to recap what I showed in this talk, there are basically, we saw two theorems due to me and my co-author. The first one was the polynomial ambiguity non-determinism, or the pole wall theorem, which said that all non-trivial counting properties of Boolean circuits are hard for polynomial ambiguity non-determinism. The second one was motivated by can we improve this theorem? And in fact, we proved that we cannot improve the theorem using relativizable techniques. So that was the Watt limit theorem. Okay. So to conclude, broad brush theorems are tools that in one go solve a lot of problems or classify a lot of problems. So this is what my thesis is about. In this talk, I showed you broad brush theorems for Boolean circuits. I have in my thesis done other broad brush theorems in other domains, namely language properties of important complexity classes like non-deterministic and probabilistic polynomial time complexity classes. Also, I have broad brush theorems for cycle length problems in graphs. So these are problems like extensions of even cycles problem, where you want to find out whether a graph has a cycle of certain modularity. So say 3 mod 5, cycle of length 5. So we give exact classification of all the problems, or at least half the problems. There are some open problems here. I also have broad brush theorems for query monotonic database access and some broad brush theorems in models of simulations. So these are models that these are theoretical models for simulations. And we also saw in this talk the optimality of the pole wall theorem, which basically says that even though it has been improved twice already, we cannot hope to improve it using standard techniques. So you have to have new techniques. And that's the end of my talk.
3 minutes for questions.
No question.
Yes.
You started the talk with, you were limiting yourself to the Boolean circuits and then the counting property.
Mm-hmm.
Then the theorem you showed was saying that all few p hard problems could be solved by calling polynomial time that subroutine.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that problems outside of Boolean circuits can be solved that way? And if so, is there some way to...
Problems outside of... I don't understand what you mean.
Well, the theorem about the few p hard thing, if you want to bring it back. Yeah.
Okay.
There's nothing...
Okay, let me go back to the... Yeah.
Okay. This looks like we can solve every problem you can get down to few p using subroutine calls to edge.
But then you're saying that there could be problems outside of few p. There could be. It's possible. But
the problems are not limited to Boolean circuits. I mean.
So what this is claiming is this: give me any few p problem, and give me any non-trivial counting property, I can solve this using subroutine calls to this.
But how large is that class of any few p problem? That's not Boolean circuit problems only. Infinite. So if I've got that subroutine, I can solve all kinds of problems.
Yes.
But is there? It's nice to know that that's possible. Is there some algorithm that?
Yes, in the proof that thing comes from the proof itself, and we have. If you look at the proof, it actually gives you a constructive algorithm. So for if you depends on that, it depends on R A. So it will depend. The algorithm will depend on A, of course.
Okay. In that case, let me go back to a question that Dr. McMillan asked earlier, namely, is there some practical use for this? And he said you didn't know yet of one for the Boolean circuit counting problem
mm-hmm.
property.
Mm-hmm.
But is there practical use using this? Can we take problems and reduce them to calls to this subroutine A?
Right.
Have you got any example?
Not in the sense of the practical, as in I could, like a practitioner would use. I, of course, would be interested in having that, and I'll make every effort to have that in my thesis. But as I said earlier, no, in the sense of, so one thing that I sort of showed earlier is the motivation for this work is is to show that you can, in fact, have one proof for many problems.
But you say you've got a constructive algorithm.
Right, we have
so
a constructive
algorithm. If I give you a problem and you can determine its few p,
yes.
Can you use the algorithm then to solve it?
Right, so, okay, good point. So there are lots of problems in few p. The only problem with classes like few p, as different from np, is that np has complete problems. So if you want to think of np, you can think of sat. That's equivalent. So if you solve, on the other hand, few p and up are what we call as semantic classes, and they don't have complete problems, or we don't know, and it's very hard to come up with. And there's a good reason for it. I can explain later. Yes.
Yeah. This brings up my question. I still would like to see a set relationship, like we draw like np, a big box, and then put the p in there, put the
np
in there.
Yeah, I sort of had that, but anyway.
Yeah. Could you?
So, yeah. It's up. Up big of one.
Okay.
Up.
Okay.
Np.
And where is np complete? Is outside?
Np complete is a subset of this. Yes. Of course, it could be that all these classes are the same. These are all empty. It could be. It's possible. If p collapses to np, all these are the same.
So is it because it's only defined for decision problems? Is it because
why they don't have complete problems? Why these classes don't have complete problems?
Yeah.
So okay, good question. So the reason these classes don't have complete problems is the following. Think of NP. How do you find the first complete problem? Mm-hmm. The way you do it is you have an enumeration of machines, and then you any other problem in NP, you also have a machine and you sort of reduce to it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this is that you don't have an enumeration of few p machines. Remember what a few p machine is. It has restricted number of accepting paths. How do you find it? In fact, even computing an enumeration is undecidable. That's why these classes do not have, these are called semantic classes. And yeah, in that sense, they are promise problems, promise classes. So all these, p is easy. P has an enumeration, because but these have other imposed conditions on them. That's why you don't have enumeration. So if you don't have an enumeration, the standard technique to construct complete problems fails there.
Okay.
Right. So if you don't have one, so basically you need one complete problem, and then you can have a variety of complete problems. But in this case, that's a problem. There are lots of classes that are important, but they don't have complete problem. Yes.
So what are the possible future directions of this research, especially since you have shown that you can't improve?
So of course, you can think of small improvements like from polynomial to log queries and so on and so forth. I mean, we have intuitions for that, and we think that actually even that is not possible, but we haven't really actually proved it. But the technique we use have enough leeway that we can actually, I think we can actually prove it. The future directions for this kind of research is, I would like to think of it in terms of having more broad brush theorems that are applicable in other areas. I also showed you in the conclusions slide that in fact, apart from my theorems in related to Boolean circuits, I have other. So one. All right. Okay. So these all have important, especially the graph problems. This has, so what we have basically, I have not shown you in this talk, but essentially we have covered half the problems. So we have covered, think about it, exactly half the problems in both directed and undirected graphs. So we need to cover the other two. Those are important. And there are problems that we prove. So we have a dichotomy theorem which says that if it has some property, it is easy. If it has some other property, it is hard. So for things that are hard, we can come up with approximation algorithms. So those are the two important. So covering more areas, and for areas we have already covered, coming up with efficient algorithms.
Actually, we ran out of time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question.